Her. Bold. Her. Brave. Her. With Dr. Pam Peek.
Hi, I'm Dr. Pam Peek, and this is episode 516 of the Bold and the Brave Her podcast. Today, I'm joined once again by Dr. Rick Kreider, and Rick is absolutely considered one of the world's experts on what we're going to talk about, which is creatine. Yes, we're talking about it again. This is part two, because we had such a fantastic amount of feedback with part one, where we just sort of went over the general issues. Today, we're going to be looking at why creatine is important for young women. I'm just telling you, Rick serves as the professor and director of the Exercise and Sport Nutrition Lab and director of the Human Clinical Core at Texas A&M University. Ladies and gentlemen, he has the street creds to talk about this. Rick, welcome back on board.
It's great to be here again.
All right. So the first time we got together, just recently, we were talking about the general gist of what goes on with creatine. Why is it important? What is it? If you can, before we launch into young women of the menstruating period of their life, so that also includes pregnancy, if you could just give us a quick little synopsis, what is creatine and why is it important to health in general?
Sure. So what's creatine? Creatine is a amino acid derived compound, part of a protein, basically, that is in every cell. And it's important in every cell because it binds with phosphate to serve as a high energy source for the cell. So when you do intense exercise or your cell needs energy, it uses this phosphocreatine for energy to maintain cellular metabolism. And so why is that important? It's almost like carbohydrate loading. You add extra carbohydrate in the muscle, then you have more energy to last longer. Well, creatine's like that, except for high-intensity sprinting exercise. So when you sprint, you use your energy, and you need that creatine, the phosphocreatine, to keep it going. So you can sprint longer and farther and recover faster. And then under metabolic conditions, like disease, you need extra energy, and that creatine phosphate is extremely important to maintain cell function when there's not a lot of oxygen around, like with a heart attack or stroke or something like that. So you need creatine in the cell for energy. And so why is this important? Well, we know that as you age, you need more creatine. Creatine becomes an important role, especially when you're doing intense exercise and when you have certain types of diseases where creatine can play a really critical role in maintaining cell metabolism during that condition.
What I'm hearing is that creatine is necessary for our very survival. So you're running away from something that, you know, wants you for lunch. That is an acute stressor. You are going to be engaging in intense physical activity, crawling up a tree, running like hell, doing whatever you have to do to be able to get away from the predator so that you can survive. So I see it as a survival nutrient. What do you think?
Yes, very important. In fact, it's the base energy system for all of life. You go back to the smallest cell, amoeba, all these type of things that we've kind of developed and been fashioned after. It's the initial energy system for life. So even in the, for example, in sperm, it's the primary energy that allows the sperm to swim. It's incredibly important for every cell. The more you have, it seems to help with metabolism, particularly under stressful conditions.
I'm sitting here like I was the very first time I had you on for creatine. And I'm like, why didn't we know this before? What had typically taken place, as we are aware, is that guys, mostly guys, who are building muscle, some women as well, more of the bodybuilding type and powerlifting and, you know, just athletic types, have used this for forever. But now I'm seeing it creep out into the mainstream. And since we're talking about women per se, oh my, suddenly women, I mean, my phone's like burning off the hook here with questions like, I just heard your podcast. What is this about this? I mean, I take my vitamin D and I do my calcium and I, you know, multivitamin. How come you've been holding back? Well, the information has been leaking out. And finally, we're at a point where it's beginning to go a tad mainstream. You're seeing more and more women's supplements for creatine, which was unheard of before because women always use the guy stuff. But now there's that going on, which I find fascinating. And then just this morning, because I emailed you with this, the Wall Street Journal had another piece on it. Hey, creatine, should you be using this? It's all the rage and back and forth, and quoting some very good studies. And I was thrilled to see that the studies now include women, which I hadn't really seen before. I saw that they included older people because they were really looking at cognition, because who knew, and nobody really talked about it in a big way outside of research, that it's not just about augmenting muscular performance and lean body mass per se, but it's also you get a benefit in the brain with cognition. Who knew? So I look at it as, you know, kind of muscle and brain, because, you know, this is an anatomical thing that we're talking about as well as function. So that's so cool. I just smiled when I saw that Wall Street Journal article saying, and now you're telling me that you were quoted in an upcoming New York Times piece. It's going to be looking at creatine as well. So guess what? We're timely. We're right on top of it. You know, we're rocking it. So if it's about women, let's talk women. Let's first like really get into younger women. So why is creatine important for just a non-pregnant young woman who is obviously menstruating? Why is this important?
Well, to kind of come off what you were talking about here is that, you know, we thought it was just for muscle building and performance. And as you start doing those studies, you start finding there's many more applications based on the role of creatine in the muscle and in metabolism and shuttling energy in and out of the cell and around the cell for use. So when you start looking at it, we did studies initially in men, and then we had men and women, and we typically saw a benefit on performance. But then you start looking at the unique physiology of women and the nutritional demands, particularly in active and stressed women. You realize that creatine may have a particular role for women as they develop throughout the lifespan, and it actually even starts during pregnancy. In pregnancy, as the baby is developing, it takes creatine from the blood of the mother and therefore uses it for neural development and muscle development. And so there's actually a greater dietary need, especially in the third trimester pregnancy in women, where the body needs more creatine to meet the needs and develop and grow with the baby. And then we look at maturation. The infant on through adolescence has greater needs for developing muscle and nerve and growth and neural development and cognition. And we know that kids that don't have creatine or can't produce their own creatine in the body have deficiencies and cognitive delays and muscle delays and things. So we actually are doing studies in infants through adolescence to try to optimize growth and development. And so when you look at specifically for women, we now know that girls and boys who don't have enough creatine in their diet as they grow into adolescence have slower growth. We know that girls, as they start going through menstruation and start having puberty, have more difficulty through that transition if they don't have enough creatine in their diet. And then you look at the unique nutrient timing factors of women around exercise and training. Before menstruation, during menstruation, after, there's greater protein needs, there's greater carbohydrate needs, and you need energy for all that so that you can develop and grow and respond after your period, et cetera, and have healthy development. And so we now know that the girls who don't have creatine in their diet don't have more menstrual cycle abnormalities than people who have a higher creatine in their diet. Then you go on to aging older. As you older, you lose muscle mass. Women, particularly after menopause, typically gain fat, they lose muscle, they lose strength, they have problems with bone. And so we now know that creatine can help with that stage of life as well. Then you add the elderly and cognition. Now you have something that can help the brain, bone, muscle as we age. So it goes to the lifespan of women around their nutritional needs and their developmental needs.
It's a mind blower. It's so important, especially during pregnancy. I've looked at a number of animal studies that appear to be quite promising and compelling as it related to neonatal neurologic development enhanced by higher levels of creatine. But what about in humans? Do we have enough human data to really start having a conversation about pregnancy, say, for instance?
I think there's enough to have the conversation about making sure you at least have quality creatine in their diet, and at least that 3 to 5 grams.
And where are we getting that?
Well, it's usually from meat and fish. And if you're not a person who eats a lot of meat and fish, then a supplement of, you know, half a teaspoon to a teaspoon a day, it's about 5 grams, it'd be plenty of creatine for those needs. I think we're already at that point. They are doing studies in infants and toddlers and in third trimester out of Australia that are being done, Stacey Elder's group down there and others. And they've actually been monitoring what happens when women have low creatine versus higher creatine as they go through that third trimester and as they go through birth, et cetera. They're finding there seems to be some very positive effects of making sure you have enough creatine in your diet. Now, whether that becomes a recommendation like folate is for women, I think that's going to take some time, but we're moving toward that direction where it's wise to make sure you have plenty of creatine in your diet, at least.
What about blood levels?
So what happens when you consume creatine, it takes about 4 to 5 hours for that level of creatine to go up in your blood. It peaks in about an hour, and it stays up for about 4 hours. And then that's when the tissues will extract it or go through transporters and gets into the tissue and store. In women, typically, once you have a meal that has some creatine in it, it goes up a little bit and it comes back down. And same thing with supplement. It goes up and it comes down. So what happens with women when they're pregnant is there's less creatine in the blood because the baby's absorbing so much for the development of the fetus. And so the mother has low creatine in the blood, reflecting the greater use of the baby, and therefore they need to have a little bit more creatine in their diet just to be able to provide the nutrients that the baby needs to develop.
It seems to me that a very good recommendation would be to supplement. When I was also mentioning blood, I'm thinking, what about blood levels? What about checking blood levels? How does that work when you're looking at a woman? Let's just say she's just menstruating, she's not pregnant or whatever, and she's also kind of vegetarian, and so she's not getting the meat and the rest of it.
So we know that people who are vegetarian have lower creatine in the blood and muscle and tissue in the brain. And so there is a greater need, if you're wanting to follow that type of diet, to actually supplement with creatine monohydrate to make sure you at least have enough creatine. We're actually working and talking with different supplement companies of adding creatine to things like soy protein, where people will take that as a substitute or some other source, be able to have a vegan, you know, whether it's pea proteins or whatever, mixed proteins, but then make sure there's enough creatine in it so you're not losing or being offset that with your protein or your diet. And so that's a minimum. The other thing I would say with pregnancy is when you have natural childbirth, it's muscle contraction. It's relaxation. It is like doing a high-intensity workout and relax over many hours in some cases, right? And so allowing the body to recover faster from muscle contractions also can help with labor and delivery. And we know that in animals that are fed creatine in their diet, and they are then caused to be birthed with a asphyxia, a lack of oxygen, like a blue baby or something that the cord goes around the neck, or a challenging type of birth, natural birth, where the baby doesn't come out as quickly through the vaginal canal. Those conditions make the baby ischemic and can then cause brain damage and other issues. And so what they found is that in animals, when they create that environment, that their recovery and survival is much better, like 50% better when they simply had more creatine in their diet. The baby can handle that lack of oxygen ischemic situation better. And so there's lots of application. Now, you can't do those type of studies, right? So it's hard to make it apply, but it makes sense. You want the baby and the mother has much energy to handle the metabolic demand of birth, as well for labor, as well as the baby surviving the natural childbirth.
Should doctors be checking creatine levels?
It's a little bit different. They can look for low levels, yes. I mean, if they're consistently low in their diet, they probably have very low levels in the blood. If they're on a normal diet that includes fish and meat, it's probably not going to be high enough fasted to make an assessment. And so even in people who take creatine supplements, their levels after fasting 12 hours, which is when we usually take our blood sample for a doctor, is really relatively low, even if they've been taking a lot of creatine, because it goes up and down within 6 hours. Now, very low levels could probably be picked up. And you certainly can pick it up with muscle concentrations, but people don't want to do biopsies all the time, but you certainly can do that.
So right now, it doesn't make any sense to do a blood level to basically check it. All you do is you infer by dietary intake where you stand. So if you're vegan or vegetarian and you're not doing fish or meat, then you can pretty much infer. I'm curious, since you've been looking at this for so long, are the vegan and vegetarian communities aware of this?
You know, there have been studies for about 20 years showing that vegetarians have a lower creatine. So I think for the athletic population that is aware of the role of creatine for performance, I think they're aware that they need to have creatine supplements because it has to offset the deficiency. I don't know, and it's why there's such an explosion of interest now. I don't know if the average person realizes what they may be deficient in if they follow that type of diet. And they know, for example, that if I don't very carefully match all my proteins, plant source of proteins, I may not have all the essential amino acids needed for growth and development and repair. I don't know that they realize that they don't bring almost no creatine in their diet if they're only getting vegan. And so they're probably more dependent on the body's production as well as supplemental creatine to make those creatine stores. And we know that vegetarians, if their body just synthesizes on their own, they're only going to have a gas tank filled about 40 to 50%. That's your body's ability to make it on its own. So you are deficient. If you have an athlete that's a vegetarian not taking creatine, they're going to have a harder time training. They're going to have a harder time performing. And then if you consider all the medical diseases in which creatine plays a role, if you have somebody with diabetes and other things and they're trying to train and they're trying to help with insulin sensitivity, that lack of creatine can make a big difference. And that's what the studies are showing.
So basically, you're saying this is also condition dependent by medical issues like type 2 diabetes, which of course is unfortunately fairly ubiquitous today. I actually call it diabesity because a little hard to see the type 2. I mean, it does exist without some obesity as well, one way or the other. So very interesting. So when we get back, I want to talk to you about athletes who are vegetarian and vegan at the Olympic level. How do they do that? The Her podcast is sponsored by Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, all rooted in nature. In addition to women's multivitamins, Solaray, S-O-L-A-R-A-Y, is presenting the new Her Life Stages products, providing support for the menstrual years, including PMS, perimenopause, menopause, and postmenopause, and even libido. This integrative holistic approach has a woman's back throughout her entire life journey. To learn more about Her Life Stages, you've got options. You can run on over to your local health food store or check it out at Whole Foods, Sprouts, Amazon, or scroll over to Solaray.com and use promo code HER20 for 20% off your purchase. Women, Solaray's got your back. And now we're back. All right, so I was asking you about Olympians. You know, I remember there were a couple swimmers who are big time vegetarians and, you know, they're winning medals. They're out there kind of rocking it. And I don't know about vegan per se, but I think vegetarian I hear more of. So are these people who, these are men that I recall, I didn't really read about women per se, but are they going out of their way to get a pretty good dose of creatine on board, knowing that they've got to maintain musculature and muscular performance, but they don't get it from their diet?
Yeah, that's what we would talk to them about. If you have an athlete that we work with that comes in and they want to follow a diet like that, they just need to know we have to make sure we get all your essential amino acids and we got to make sure we get creatine content. Because carbohydrates and other things are usually okay, but it's usually those are the main limitations. So if you had a vegetarian athlete, they're trying to perform on very low fuel. Now, for a 50 or 100 meter race, that might be enough in there for your normal synthesis to do that type of thing. But when you go beyond about 20, 30 seconds in duration, you really need a lot more creatine to foster creatine to maintain the energy, ATP. You really are putting a limitation in performance. And so we would sit down and say, okay, we don't want to change your philosophy, but you need to know this is how you're going to have to really take care of this. And I don't see how you can really perform well if you're not taking at least creatine supplements, if you're doing high intensity exercise. Now, if you're a long distance runner, an ultra runner, and you're really not doing very intense levels of exercise, you're depending more on fat as the fuel, you may not need to do that, but almost every endurance athlete has to sprint at some time during the race. The Tour de France, you run 100 miles, that last 5K is all out sprint to the end to finish. And if you don't have the energy and the muscle at that point, you're not going to perform as well.
Well, even in training, when, you know, I was learning marathon training years ago, we did fartleks. Just look that up. That isn't like a GI issue. It's basically just you're running track, you're running around the track, and then every now and then you time it out yourself, you figure it out, plan it. You run really, really fast, and then you bring it back down again, then you run really, really fast. And so even if you're just training for a marathon or an ultra marathon, you know, you still have to incorporate into your training a boatload of sprints because they actually build your endurance when you do something like that. So, all right, let's go back to women now. Let's think about this for a second. All right, for women, they wake up in the morning. How are they going to do some creatine? Because now they're going to say, okay, I heard you. This influences in a beneficial way my menstruation. Okay, I want to be as healthy as possible, brain and muscle. Tell me about how we do this. What's the dosing look like? How do I separate it out? So in the morning, how do they do it? Let's just say, are you supposed to time it out with your workout in a big way? And if anything, it kind of moves you toward a workout too.
Yeah, the most important thing is you have enough in the diet. Around the workout, I think there's a little bit of evidence. Maybe it helps. It's not as important as the amount you get in a day. So what we recommend is you wake up, whether you have coffee, a smoothie, or whatever you have, just add a teaspoon of creatine at that point. That's about 5 grams. And then as you go the rest of the day, whenever you do your post-workout drink or have a smoothie or a carbohydrate protein drink, or even after your meal, throw another teaspoon in there. So you get 2 doses a day of 5 grams, separated out by about 6 or 8 hours. And that would be plenty for the body to have enough creatine to peak and come back down and keep those muscle and brain and other tissues saturated with creatine well.
Let's go with that blood level again. So when you said peak, all right, so I'm going to just drill it down so everybody understands. So I wake up in the morning and I say to myself, okay, I heard the creatine chorus. So now I'm going to change things up so I can make sure to get my full 10 grams in and do it appropriately. So I'm going to, you know, have my little smoothie for breakfast. Let's just say that's at 8. I'm making things up here. And then I put in 5 grams. And if you buy the powder, there's a little spoon there that's exactly 5 grams. So that's kind of a no-brainer. There are gummies out there as well that you can also use that work perfectly fine. And obviously they're labeled as 5 grams, et cetera. So let's just say you go ahead and you do the creatine right then. All right, now it's 8 o'clock. It's going to peak over the course of...
By about noon, you should have a peak, and it should start dissipating away. So again, it takes about 1 to 2 hours to peak, and it takes about 4 to 5 hours to go back down towards baseline. So you kind of get this big increase. So by lunch, or maybe your mid-afternoon snack would be a good time for another creatine dose. Or if you work out in the afternoon, do a post-workout drink, which you have protein and some creatine in it, and that's all you'd have to do.
So on a day when we're not working out, it's a recovery day, say, for instance. So all you got to do is just make certain that you time it out appropriately, looking at roughly 8 hour separation, right? 8 hour. Okay. Now, if I'm going to work out, what if I work out in the morning? So now what I'm going to do is I'm going to have an early smoothie. It's got some good stuff in it. Now I'm going to have a nice intense workout. I'm going to be lifting weights. Now, should I wait on that first creatine until it's post-workout?
I prefer or recommend post-workout with protein, like a whey protein, or soy would be fine for women. The reason is because that stimulates protein synthesis, those essential amino acids. And we know that if you consume creatine with carbohydrate, usually they have some carbohydrate in your post-workout and high-quality protein, that helps with creatine absorption. It also helps with glycogen retention. So after exercise is a great time to consume creatine because you're getting protein synthesis, glycogen recovery, and loading creatine as well.
Is there a time period after exercise that is most optimal for the combination of protein and creatine?
So we usually recommend within 30 minutes after intense exercise to take a smoothie or energy bar. Okay. Whether 2 hours later is any better than 30 minutes, probably not. But we always say 30 minutes because we want you to think, when I get done working, I got to refuel. And then after that, you can have your meal an hour or two later whenever you're ready to eat your meal. But we always want our athletes to know you should have a snack before you work out, just to get a little bit of carbohydrate, amino acids in your muscle. And then after workout, we always tell our athletes the most important time to refuel is after exercise, carbs, protein, creatine.
Excellent. So now I've had my morning workout. Let's just say I worked out between 9 and 10. I don't know, I'm just making it up. So now I'm going to have my protein and my creatine. That's the 5 grams. Boom. So now I wait 8 hours. And later on, something I might be thinking about is, you know, what if I just did some endurance? What if I left my nice long walk with a friend until then? So would it be cool to then have the creatine after that long walk? Say I did a 4-miler.
Yeah, if it's in the afternoon, no problem. So if you had your first dose around 10, I would wait till 2 or 3 to have another. It doesn't hurt to have another one, but you want to be able to keep and maintain the levels for a while so the body has enough time to absorb. So, you know, if it's 2 or 3 o'clock walk, great. After that, have another dose. Or would it hurt to wait till before you go to bed? No. As long as you're getting in your body throughout the day, that's the most important thing. And then if you are going to exercise, after exercise always makes more sense.
So as you know, because you're the expert, and I learned from you, the early studies utilizing creatine in older individuals were just 5 grams. And you said that, yes, there's no question with combined with resistance training, et cetera, you were able to see some positive benefit in terms of lean body mass and function. Later on, they looked at cognitive performance as well. So that's all good. When did it change to be from 5 grams to 10 grams? Why is it important not to be just doing the 5 gram? Because I hear this all the time with women who read something, you know, dear God, please don't go to TikTok. Just do me a huge favor and avoid that place. You know, where they hear, oh, I did my 5 grams in the morning. I'm so cool for the rest of the day. I'm thinking, no, Dr. Kreider has other thoughts on that. Tell us about why 10 grams is more beneficial than 5.
Yeah, it's basically if you just want muscle benefits, 5 grams a day after loading is plenty. But if you want brain effects, which is the cognitive point, it takes a little bit more creatine per day to help increase creatine in the brain. It's because creatine's not absorbed across the blood-borne barrier as well. And so it takes a little longer dosage, a more sustained increase in the blood creatine to penetrate and also get into the tissue of the brain. And so most of the rehabilitation type of studies and the Parkinson's and all these things have been studied, they've all used very high doses, up to 30 grams per day, because they're trying to get neurogenic, neurological, and brain effects. And so the dosage seems to be the most effective in middle-aged and older folks. 2 5-gram doses a day, 10 total, seems to be enough to help the brain. In fact, that's what we're studying right now in our older studies that we're looking specifically enhancing brain cognition effects. So you get muscle effects with 5, but brain effects, the added benefits to the tissue, with 10.
Tell us the difference, because this came back from our feedback from that first marvelous part 1 on creatine with you, and that is the difference between creatine and creatinine.
Sure.
A lot of us know creatinine because it's on our lab tests, and that's when our lovely physicians, me included, would say, let's look at your kidney function. So what is the relationship between the two? I want you to explain it. And what happens to creatine when we take it during the day relative to creatinine?
So when you consume creatine, 99% of that creatine is taken up by the tissue or excreted in the urine as creatine. Very little is converted to creatinine. Creatine is converted to creatinine when you use it, a lot of it in muscle contraction, you degrade it a little bit, breaks down on its own. And the body actually will break down about 1% to 2% of your creatine stores, whatever's in the muscle, per day. And that's what gives you that baseline creatinine value. Basically, the more muscle mass you have, the more physical activity that you have, the more turnover of creatine to creatinine, because it's going to break down eventually, the higher your creatinine may be. Now, if your kidney's not doing a good job functioning, it will have an elevation because the body's breaking all this tissue down. And so abnormal levels of creatinine could be a first sign of kidney problems. However, the caveat is, unless you're taking creatine, because you're going to have a little bit of creatine that will naturally be broken down to creatinine. If you have more muscle mass, you have more creatinine that will naturally break down per day. And if you're more physically active, you'll have a natural amount of more creatine. So you can't just look at creatinine as an indicator of kidney function if they're doing creatine. And so what we do in those cases, there's more sophisticated tests, a little bit better to look at, better assessment.
Fractionated. Yeah.
Yes. And then we find out, creatine doesn't cause any of these problems. It's just a natural breakdown because you have more in the body. And so creatinine is not a great indicator of creatine stores. It's a better indicator of how much breakdown there might be. And so there is a little bit of relationship there, but it's not due to kidney function problems.
Fantastic. That's excellent. I had a question from someone who had seen the first podcast, basically saying, hey, I've got my annual physical coming up and I'm all in. I've been doing the 10 grams and I'm telling you right now, I can see a difference in my performance. I'm loving it. Thank you, Dr. Kreider. However, I have my annual coming up and they want to draw my blood. Now, should I stop the creatine ahead of time so that it doesn't give a fictitiously high level of creatinine? This is someone who's doing a lot of physical activity now and intense. So is it a day, 2 days? What do you do? Do you have to do anything? What?
Shouldn't have to do anything. And so the reason is it takes about 4 to 6 weeks of taking extra creatine in your diet to get your creatine stores higher. And then you'll see a natural turnover of creatine to creatinine, which might slightly increase creatinine. But it only takes 6 hours of consuming creatine before it gets back down to baseline in the blood. And so if you take a blood sample and you're fasted for 12 hours, you're not going to see more creatine in the blood, and your creatinine won't be affected that acutely. In fact, pharmacokinetic studies show that it doesn't break down at all to creatinine when you take oral doses of creatine. It's usually just from this normal turnover because of more muscle mass. In fact, creatinine is used as an indicator of muscle mass in some populations. The more creatinine
You
have, the more muscle you have. And so it's an indication of aging that if it's going down, it might actually be because you're losing a lot of muscle too.
Oh, how interesting. So someone like myself, I tend to be more muscular. All right, I had to do that. Showing everyone my biceps, of course. So my turnover, because I've actually quantified my lean body mass very nicely, and I'm well into the triple digits, which is kind of cool because most women are 60 pounds, 70 pounds of lean body mass, and I've never seen that. I'm always in the triple digits. So if that's true, I'm asking you, would I have a higher level of creatine turnover?
You should, yes. So the more muscle mass and the more active you are, because you're using the energy systems, right, the more creatinine you may have. But they're still within normal clinical ranges. So, for example, a normal creatinine in the blood is 0.8 to 1, 1.1 maybe. An active college football player who's not taking creatine, maybe 1.1 to 1.3. Well, they've got a lot more muscle. They're doing a lot more activity. And so their values are higher. When you take those football players and give them creatine, you generally don't see an increase in creatinine compared to placebo at all. In fact, our safety studies substantiated that with 13,000 on creatine or not. There was no differences in creatinine between the groups at all when you average it out. However, the more muscle mass you have, generally the higher values. And usually a physician won't be concerned about it unless they see it getting 1.3, 1.4, 1.5 is like, better check this out. We've actually had studies in our long-term safety studies in football players, and the athletes who were not taking creatine had higher creatinine than the people taking creatine. And there were some of them at the 1.1, 1.5 because it's muscle mass, it's training volume, and if you're dehydrated at all, it could also elevate that number. So we are always educating physicians because they've learned creatinine, warning, when it gets to a certain level. But you have to think of the context. Are they training? Do they have more muscle mass? Are they dehydrated? Because all those factors could artificially increase your blood level, and you might think there's a problem, and then you do more sophisticated tests and find out there's no problem on kidney function at all.
I don't think there's any question, Rick, that you need to be standing in front of many physician groups, big association meetings, and tell physicians this. I can absolutely guarantee you that the grand majority of you, just your typical family practitioner, internal medicine person, is not aware of this at all. And if creatine is going to be utilized more and more by mainstream public, male and female, I think that they should be much more aware so that when there is some level of elevation or back and forth, they don't freak out and say, there you have it. This actually happened with someone I've been following, and this is a 65-year-old woman who is active, listened to the podcast, literally ran out and got the creatine and did her thing. And her creatinine was up just a little bit. And she had a highly conservative, physician who said, we're going to have to follow your kidney function. Immediately I got a phone call and I said, calm down now. More importantly, we're going to also be doing part two today. So I'm going to make sure she listens to the podcast today and refer her physician to it as well to say, calm down. Everything is just fine because she's been loving it. She feels better.
This is not unusual. And so what we often do is share the literature with the physician on creatine, physician stand on creatine. We even have a couple papers on common myths, and one section is on renal function. And then I'll blow your mind here. They just did an NHANES study that published a few months ago or so. And they looked at people with higher and lower creatine in their diet by looking at diet analysis and NHANES and comparing how much meat and fish is in the diet, et cetera. And the people with low creatine in their diet had more renal failure and function problems than people with higher creatine in their diet. Completely opposite of the myth. And so this brings up an issue. One of the things we've always talked about is we got to get the word out, physicians and practitioners, so they can provide good information to their patients. And it's not just going and asking your physician. If they're not knowledgeable about some of the basics of nutrition and performance and health, an application of some of these nutrients that can really help their patients, they're just going to tell them not to do it because, oh, I've been told don't do these things, and they don't know the literature. So many of our people share the literature. I even had to do that when my mom had cancer. Because we know that if you had cancer, not only creatine help, but there's also things like HMB and essential amino acids and things that prevent the loss of muscle as you're going through chemo. And there's actually data on creatine that also shows the same thing. And I had to share the literature with this prominent physician at a major clinic, one of the top in the country, and they had no idea about all the nutritional management that can be done in patients to help them tolerate chemo and all these things much better. And he's like, thanks for sharing this. I had no idea about this. So yeah, we're trying to get the word out, whether it's at conferences, publications, summaries, podcasts. There's a lot of potential value of nutrition and health. You think about it. You can't optimize health unless you have good nutrition, physical activity. It's all combined. And then you throw cognitive health and all that other stuff. It's all related. So you just can't focus just on physical or mental. It's got to be a combination to promote real wellness and improve quality of life.
I remember how shocked I was when I found out somewhere along the line that creatine is used in the ICU. Because think about it. I mean, you're not going anywhere. You're tied up. Your tube to orifice ratio exceeds unity, which is what we constantly say in the ICU. So you are ill with whatever happened. You're not moving. You're dropping lean body mass as fast as you could say go. And your cognition is also suffering terribly with the godforsaken stress of being in there, especially if you're on a ventilator or whatever the issue is. So they are supplemented with creatine, and this goes hand in hand with the total parenteral nutrition and all the good things we give them, these wonderful, precious patients, to keep them alive. So once I heard that, it's like, wow, that's street creds, the ICU. You know, I'm going to go with that one.
Yeah, they've been using creatine in IV solutions since the 1970s.
Yep.
And it was initially used for heart failure and arrhythmia conditions where you're ischemic, your heart doesn't have oxygen. It has to rely on other energy systems, right? And so providing phosphocreatine and the energy sources helps the cell meet the metabolic demands. So you don't have as much damage, don't have as much problem. And we now know in animals, if you cause a heart attack and you had animals fed on creatine diets versus not, that the size of the infarction, the death of the tissue, is about a third the size. It preserves or prevents a lot of those ischemic cells around the dying cells to maintain viability to help reduce the size of the heart attack. And so this also makes sense in the brain in stroke. It actually showed lower loss of tissue from stroke, less damage from spinal cord injuries, or an animal study. So it all makes sense. And what people don't realize is you think, oh, I just heard about this, but there's actually been studies for a long time. In fact, at the Germany conference a few weeks ago, I did kind of a history of creatine. And, you know, they actually founded it in the 1800s and figured out there's something involved in energy. There were studies in the 1920s in women and in infants and kids back in the 1920s. They didn't know what it was. They didn't know how, but they knew that if they fed folks these type of things that had high creatine content, they seemed to do better. And so there actually have been studies a long time on this. And, you know, sometimes we think it has to be new to be better. Sometimes there's some of the old literature. Actually, they were onto something. They just didn't know quite what it was. And as we become more sophisticated, better testing and methodologies, understanding what metabolism is going on, it's opened up a new world about how creatine can play a role in health and function as we age.
Rick, I cannot tell you, you know, how thankful I am that I know you, that I'm aware of your fabulous expertise and research. And most importantly, on behalf of so many of the women here who have responded by saying, my God, I had no idea. And now I'm just going to hop to it. Who knew? And thanks for helping me on my journey. It's not just about, you know, hitting the gym, lifting the weights, doing the gig. Like you said, it's an integrative, holistic experience. It's got to be exercise, nutrition, sleep, stress management. The whole thing is interconnected. And the creatine is going to end up being like the big guy. I mean, I'm writing my next book right now, and I've got like 9,000 pages on creatine because I'm so into it now, because I want to share the good news. Share the good news. I mean, that's just the way it goes. Rick, I can't thank you enough for being on the Herb podcast once again to shed so much wonderful wisdom and light on such an important topic. Thank you for everything you do, Rick.
You're welcome. Leave you one last word. Exercise plus nutrition, creatine, equals health and performance.
Oh, I love it. Say it again, one more time, exercise.
Exercise plus nutrition, including creatine, equals health and performance.
Okay. Loving every single moment of that. And with that, of course, we're going to have you back for probably part 3, 4, 5, and 6, at least. But thank you for today. And I want to thank my wonderful sponsor, Solaray Vitamins, Minerals, and Herbs, which are all rooted in nature and the new Her Life Stages products. Please scope it all out at Solaray, Solaray.com. And hey, take a moment now, leave us a review, because we love to hear from you. That's from me to you to me. All right. This has been a production of Podcast Health. Please remember, your time in this world may be limited, but the things you can do with that time are not. So get on out there and seize the day with your creatine, of course. Thanks for listening, everyone.